Romans chapter 11, we have been dealing with Paul's concepts as he presented them, starting in verse 16, where he introduced the first difficult issue that if the root is holy, the branches are holy, and then turns right around and talks about breaking some of them off. That set up a bit of a conundrum, because you don't break holy branches off. But if they're not holy, then why did he say they were? So we worked with that. And then we also looked at the issue of the branches being broken off and other branches being grafted in, and then the caution in verse 21 that if God didn't spare the natural branches, he won't spare the grafted ones either if they get off target. And he even says, in verse 22, if you don't continue in his goodness, you'll be cut off. So these are things that we've been working with. Last week we really attempted to tackle this doctrine of pruning in the light of the doctrine of sovereign election, because it was Paul who was the one who declared in chapter 8, in verse 30, that he had become persuaded that nothing could separate him from the love of God, and he had identified the people he was talking about in terms of those heavy sovereignty themes of predestination, calling, justification, and glorification. And he even raised the issue in verse 33 of chapter 8, who shall bring a charge against God's elect? And the answer was, it's God who justifies, so it's a waste of time to charge the elect with anything. So Paul is the one who set out this concept of the absolute security of the justified. But it's also Paul here in chapter 11 who's warning his readers that God will not spare them if they act like the natural branches acted, and if they don't continue in his kindness, they'll be broken off just like the natural branches were. So it's really the words of Paul that, when we combine them with our ignorance of his understanding of God, that we have this tension that develops. And theologically it's a massive thing, because it's usually cast in the light of Calvin-Arminian controversy, and that's been going on for centuries. And Calvin didn't start that either. Augustine was way earlier than Calvin was. So you have these theological tension issues, and Paul's the one that created them in a very real sense, because he's the one who's been teaching this. So in our study last time, I attempted to show that Paul's concept of faith is a concept of a continuum, where faith begins at a point, and then there is a period of development, and if all goes well in this period of development, there comes a crisis of stability, and then beyond that, there is the process that leads into the eternal future. And for Paul, the beginning point of faith is the exposure to God's truth, and we made the claim last time that it can be any of his truths. When a human being believes something that's true, he benefits from the faith in that truth according to how that truth brings benefit to him. And it doesn't matter if he's a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or whatever. It's just the way the universe works. When you believe something that's true, you benefit from it. But the alternative is also true, that when you believe a lie, you suffer consequences of it, even if you don't think it's a lie. And even if you resist the identification of it as a lie, and you endure all the stuff it's bringing to you, deceived into thinking it's something else is causing it, you still live with the consequences. So Paul would argue that the issue here is exposure to the claims of Jesus of Nazareth as being the Christ. But nobody starts that kind of faith without having believed a lot of other stuff too. At some point, however, this faith in Jesus as the Christ comes to what I call a point of solidification, where
it settles. And this is what you now are convinced is true. And I believe this is the point of justification. And once a person is justified, Paul says in Romans 8, he's also glorified, so the result from here down is what Paul would call, well, let me say it this way. Paul is the one who taught that the Gentiles were grafted into the tree, and he argues that it's on the basis of faith. But he doesn't claim that that grafting is simultaneous to any concept of justification. He doesn't make that claim. I believe that he actually understood the point of faith as occurring before its solidification point. So the grafting would occur before the faith is actually solidified, and therefore it's not an irreversible reality, because Paul taught 2 Timothy 2:18 that faith can be overturned. Jesus taught that there are some who, when they hear, they receive it with great joy, but as soon as trouble hits, having no root, he says they believe for a while and then dump it. Paul made a comment in Titus 1:1 when he wrote to Titus. He addressed the issue of the faith of the elect of God. And by that terminology, he is making a distinction between the faith of everybody else. So there are different kinds of levels of commitment or conviction. And if a person is, according to Romans 8:33, an exerciser of the faith of God's elect, nobody can bring an effective charge against them because God's the one who justifies. So I believe that what Paul is arguing in Romans chapter 11, because of the fact that he's introducing this problem here, glorying over the branches, and this problem here, being high-minded instead of being fearful, these two indicate a type of faith that is pre-solidification, where they've bought into the identity of Jesus as the Christ, kind of like Judas did, or any of the other 11 too, early on, before they had to really make up their minds. We've seen the record where they began to be disciples and he even appointed them apostles, but he did all that before he ever asked them, well, who do you say that I am? So they were in this stage of development and their faith was being built to a point. Obviously, it didn't work for Judas. So I really believe that the issue of the grafting is a pre-justification issue, and the boasting and the high-mindedness that might follow simply shows that that kind of faith is actually a departure from the goodness and kindness of God, and it results in a reversal of the grafting, because that's what God did to the Jews who rejected the truth, having been immersed in it. Now this evening, we're going to approach the issues that he's dealing with here according to the next issue that's in verse 17. We've dealt with breaking off holy branches, quote unquote. We've dealt with the fact that the branches were broken off and the warning that if he didn't spare the natural branches, he won't spare you either. If you don't continue his goodness, you'll be cut off like the natural branches were. We've dealt with that stuff. Now, this evening, I want to talk about the root of the fatness. What in the world is that? Well, we're going to start by talking about the fatness. Paul is the only person that uses this word in the New Testament, and this is the only place he uses it. So he brings a word into the revelation here that he doesn't use anywhere else, so he assumes that we will get the point if we just back up a little bit and look at what he's been talking about. So I want us to think about what Paul means by the fatness. He's talking about a root that produces this, but what is fatness? What is he dealing with here? Well, I think that he's really dealing with what he was addressing earlier in the chapter. Let's back up to verse 11, where he introduces the issue of them being broken off. His illustration is down here in verse 16, where the root and the branches in the olive tree and all that are actually brought in as an illustration. But the concepts
of the Jews being broken off and stumbling is raised here in verse 11, and what he says is that by their fall, salvation has come to the Gentiles. So, I believe that his definition of fatness is salvation. That means being delivered from the impact that sin makes at multiple levels, being brought out of that so that not only are we not subject to its consequences and the death impact and all that, but we're actually delivered from the practices of it if we're believing. So salvation's part of the fatness issue. And then in verse 12, he returns the same issue of verse 11. Did they stumble, they might fall? No. But by their fall, salvation has come. Now, if their fall is the riches of the world and they're lost the riches of the Gentiles, and again, I think that the word riches is his meaning for fatness. So I want you to think about salvation as something that's really rich. That's what he's dealing with. And then he goes on. Down here in verse 15, he says, if the casting away of them is the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be? So here, he introduces with the word reconciling, the methodology. Earlier, he said their stumbling brought salvation. Their fall brought riches. Now, their casting away is bringing about the reconciling of the world. So this is the method, reconciling. What he's talking about is getting human beings and God on the same wavelength. That's they're reconciled. And this is the issue of the fatness, and he climaxes it in this verse. He calls it resurrection life. If the reconciling of the world occurs at the casting away, the receiving will be life from the dead. That's resurrection life. Now, we all know that in point of time, the receiving of Israel will be during the 70th week of Daniel, and life from the dead will be real resurrection life, because we will already have been caught up to be with the Lord, our bodies will already been transformed, we'll already be in the fullness of the resurrection life. But don't forget chapter 6, where we were baptized in his death and his resurrection, so that we were put to death in the flesh so that we could live newness of life now. So there is a quality of experience called resurrection life that is experienceable before the resurrection happens. That's the life we have by the first fruits of the Spirit. So this is what I believe he's talking about when he addresses this question of the fatness. When he says, you have become a partaker with them of the root of the fatness. He's really talking about a qualitative experience in time that has to do with being reconciled to God, so that you're walking with him in harmony. And in harmony with him, you're receiving the salvation issues, you're receiving the wealth issues, because you're walking with him. Now, in these days, there are many, 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 many people who claim to be Christians, and they're not walking with God. And as a consequence, their lives are not a manifestation of the fatness. And we don't dare let that argue against its reality, because it is real. You can have a reconciled relationship that is peaceful, even in the midst of very difficult circumstances. So he says you've become partakers of the root of the fatness. And when he talks about this fatness thing, I think that we need to be aware that really what he's tapping into is this concept of a life that's empowered by resurrection reality. It's a super life beyond the ordinary. It's the ability to have peace in the midst of terrible circumstances. It's the ability to have subliminal joy in the face of grief. It's the ability to rejoice when everything's falling apart and give thanks in the face of whatever. That's the issue. That's the kind of life that he's talking about. Now, one thing that we have to keep in mind is Paul's concept of faith as a continuum issue. Whenever we think about faith as a one-time event kind of activity, we actually
reduce our experience of the fatness, because we tend to fall back on our past experience of faith at some point, and we think that that's carrying us when it's really not. Faith was designed to be a continuum, something that is going forward, so that you begin to believe at a point, but you don't stop believing if you're really operating by faith. So that each day is an exercise of dependence and faith. We got to keep that in mind. Another thing that we have to keep in mind is that Paul's presentation of the potential for resurrection life in time before the resurrection is a preliminary experience. He said in Romans 8 that we have this earnest of the Spirit even while we groan in our bodies. So there's a tension. Our lives are not everything they could be, but they're not as bad as they could be either, because we're in this interim between the time that we were reconciled to God and are walking in that reconciliation and the time when He actually brings the fulfillment of the promises to pass. So that the present experience can be real, but it's a preliminary, it's not the fullness. And what we have to understand is that the continuum idea of faith going through the days, so that we don't just believe 2 years ago and, you know, we are constantly walking in a reconciled relationship. That and the experience that comes out of it coalesce into a reality that at any time anyone believes anything that's true, he or she participates in the preliminary benefits of whatever that truth brings. And the opposite reality stands too. Every time we believe a lie, we are subject to the consequences of that. And the big task of God is keeping those things in balance. Because none of us believe perfectly every day. As a consequence, our life experience is a mix. And how God brings the blessing to us that comes from believing truth and yet allows the imposition of the death impact of believing lies to be there too, how He does that's beyond me. Just, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. That's Paul's end of chapter 11. Because it's quite a job that God has set for Himself in dealing with us as His children, because we live in a mixed reality. But the thing I want you to keep in mind is what He called it. He said that you have become a partaker of the fatness. And I would challenge you to let that word become a question for you every day. Is my life an experience of the fatness? Because if it's not, there's something that needs to be addressed. And if it is, you need to realize what you're doing to make that possible as an act of faith and pursue that. Because life is not just going with flow. It's making deliberate choices that are in harmony with what you've learned to be true. And you trust it. And you look at the things that you experience and you say, okay, why is this happening? And then you look back to see the causes. And if you're wise, you'll say, well, that's death, and I'm not going to do that anymore. By the grace of God. Obviously, it's got to be spiritually motivated. But I want you to remember that He uses the term fatness. That's the quality of our experience if we walk in a reconciled relationship. Fatness. Now, having said that, I want us to think about the prior issue, the root. He said that you have become partakers of the root. Now, this is where it gets a little bit dicey if we just forget what we've learned in Romans before 11. I mean, it's really easy when we spend 6 or 7 years working our way through a book and only getting this far to lose sight of stuff that we studied months and perhaps years ago. But the root that Paul is talking about has already been established. It was established in his argument back in Romans chapter 4. And so I want to go there. Now, I want you to notice way back there in Romans chapter 4 that he raises the issue of Abraham, our forefather, and what he had discovered.
And he's talking here about Abraham believing God and how at a point in time in the believing, his faith stabilized to the point where he was justified. Now keep this in mind. Genesis chapter 12, where the Abrahamic covenant was given to Abraham, was three chapters before Genesis 15:6, where it says, Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. So it's part of my argument that even Abraham started to believe at some point before it actually stabilized and he was justified. But nonetheless, he says that this righteousness came as a consequence of him believing. Now, when we go on down to the outcome of Abraham, our forefather, obviously he's talking Jewish talk there in some ways, but I want you to follow this logic in verse 9 and following. He says, is this blessing then pronounced upon the circumcision or upon the uncircumcision also? He's asking, does it apply only to the Jews or does it also apply to the Gentiles? And he says, we say to Abraham, his faith was reckoned for righteousness. Okay, this is Genesis 15. How was it reckoned? When he was in circumcision or uncircumcision? Well, the circumcision thing didn't come till Genesis 17. So, the Genesis 15 is obviously prior. That means not in circumcision. That's a metaphor for, while in this mentality of the Jewish issue, but in uncircumcision. I don't know if you've ever thought about it or not, but Abraham started out as a Gentile. Here's this one of many people who are among the nations of the world. And when God chose him to give to him the Abrahamic covenant and to develop the nation of Israel from him, he started with a Gentile. And then he said to this Gentile, I'm going to make of you a great nation. And that nation was Israel. So he was going to create Israel out of this man. So on the one hand, Abraham is the father of everyone who believes. He says right here that Abraham might be the father of all them that believe. But the reasoning is because his faith was exercised first in uncircumcision, so that any uncircumcised person who believes like he did becomes his son. And then he was given the issue of circumcision in Genesis 17. Every person born in his house was to be circumcised. And those people were his offspring genetically. But I want you to notice what he says about them in verse 12. He is the father of those who are circumcised, if they're not just circumcised, but also walk in the steps of his faith. Now, think about this. Abraham is the root of the fatness. God chose Abraham to be the root for the blessing that has come upon the whole world. And the way Paul argues it is, he's the root because he got the justification by faith before he was a Jew, if we can say it this way, while he was in uncircumcision. And then he was given the promise of a developing nation that would become Israel, and he was given circumcision as a sign of that covenant. And so the uncircumcised are his sons by faith, and the circumcised are his sons if they're circumcised and believe. So that the circumcision is a subsidiary issue. The real issue is faith. And that's what Paul's arguing in chapter 11. So, Abraham is the root. He's the root of the Israelites who both participate in the circumcision issues of Jewishness, and he's the father of the uncircumcised because that's how he got justified by faith in the first place, while he was uncircumcised. So, that's Paul's early development of this concept that he's going to come back to in chapter 11 when he talks about the root. Abraham's the root. But we have to understand that Abraham's identity as the root is a two-part issue. It's the man and his faith. And that means that any who are going to participate in the fatness that comes out of the root have to be tied to the man. In Now let me show you how really interesting that comment is when we go to Galatians. The terminology in Galatians 3 is really a little bit of a shock, because it says in verse 29, if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's seed. Now that sounds like it's almost backwards. A Jew would say, if you're Abraham's seed, then you belong to Christ, and you're an heir according to the promise. But Paul didn't say it that way. He said, look, the key issue is being one of Abraham's seed. This is the key, because you're going to be an heir according to the promise if you are tied to the root. But how do you get tied to the root? Well, in Galatians, it's by being tied to Christ. And if you belong to Him, then you are Abraham's seed, and then you are an heir. Now, in Romans chapter 4, verse 13, Paul made this statement. Not through the law was the promise to Abraham. In other words, the promise was to Abraham, but it was not through the law. It was not to his seed through the law. But notice what the promise is, that he should be heir of the world. Now, I don't know if you thought about that, but the promise to Abraham was that he would be the heir of the world. That means he's going to inherit the world. Well, what does that mean? Well, at the end of the book of the Revelation, we know what it means. There's a new heaven, a new earth, and the outcome of the big plan of God for the final kingdom state is that all of those who have believed in the promise are now heirs of the entire ball of wax. That's inheriting the world and everything that comes with it. So I want you to think about that, because in chapter 11 of Romans, he is arguing that you actually have to be tied to the man. That's the point of the grafting in of the branches. If you're not a Jew, you have no connection to the man Abraham. Paul said in Ephesians, that makes you aliens to the covenants of the promise. You're strangers. That makes you alienated from God. So you have to be connected to the root, the man. Now, how do you get the connection? Well, you have to remember, he was a Gentile when he got his justification by faith. So if you're willing to believe the promise that he was given, like he did, then you can be connected to him as a son by faith. And if you do that, you become Christ, and that makes you Abraham's seed, and that makes you an heir of the world. So you have to be connected to the man. You have to be grafted into the tree of which he's the root in order to participate in the fatness. If you're not grafted into the tree, you don't participate in the fatness. And that's really crucial, because now I want us to talk about the particulars. What are the issues of the fatness in terms of the particulars? Now here we're going to go back to, way back to the stuff we began to study when we first came, and the Genesis 12, 1 to 3 concept of the body, soul, and the spirit being met by land, great nation and a great name. This is going to be review, but I want you to remember that the Genesis 12, 1 to 3 commitment that God made to this man is a commitment that produces the fatness. If Abraham gets to experience the fulfillment of those three promises that God made, his life will be filled with the fatness of the root, which is his participation in the promise. Now, what were the issues? Well, Genesis 12 has the Genesis 2 and 3 background. In Genesis 2, we're told that man is created physically. He is a soul and he has a spirit. He's got a body, soul, and spirit. And each one of those are risk issues in Genesis chapter 3. So the temptation in Genesis 3 attacks at all three of those levels. Something to eat, the issue of seeing with your eyes, all this stuff that will enable you to be happy and satisfied and all that, and the spiritual issues of having a task in the garden that's worth doing, and the counter argument that the serpent made is you can be like God. You can run your own life. Well, that meant two things about
Abraham as well as all of humanity, and that is, we are by nature tripartite. We have three parts to us, and we have a serious potential for deception. When you got three basic elements of your life, but you're subject to the weakness of deception, then you're in danger in three ways, depending on what you believe. So we see from Genesis 3 to Genesis 12 that humanity didn't handle it. They blew it at the physical level, they blew it at the soul level, they blew it at the spiritual level, and they blew it so badly that in chapter 6 through 9, God wiped them out with flood, and then after that, they blew it again with the Tower of Babel thing. So men just don't handle it very well. So God said, look, let's get a handle on this. So he took a man, Abraham, and he said, I'm going to address the three areas of your need with this deception weakness with three commitments I'm going to make to you. Abraham, I want you to leave your land because I'm going to take you to a land that will supply everything your body ever needs. I want you to leave your father's house where you have this sense of security because you're surrounded by relatives. And I will make of you a great nation, so you'll be surrounded by even more, and your sense of security will grow. And I want you to leave your father's house where you get your identity and your sense of who you are and your significance, and I'm going to give you a great name. So those are the three things that constitute the foundation of the fatness. When a person has everything his body needs, everything his soul needs, everything his spirit needs, he's fat. That's a figure of speech. But it means that we're rich if we have what we need. And that's where I believe that Paul's concept here in the root of the fatness is actually developed. Because the olive tree was the outgrowth of the commitment God made to the man Abraham when he addressed all of his needs with specific promises. And those promises carry through. Now, there's some changes along the way. Let me see if I can explain it this way. What did a branch from the domesticated olive experience in terms of the fatness, according to the promises? Well, they got to live in the land, and they participated in a great nation, and they benefited from the great name of their progenitor, Abraham. And in the outworking of this, we have the illustrations, for example, of David and Solomon and some of the times of great fatness for the people because they were led by people of men of faith. So this was what they got. Well, what does the branch that is out of the wild olive, when he's grafted in, what does he experience? Does he become a Jew? This is the great mistake theologically that happened after Paul's letters got old. There was a whole host of Christendom that said that the church has become a spiritual Israel, and so the promises are now to the church, and Israel has no future because the church is the fulfillment. But let me ask you this. Does that make any sense in terms of grafting? When I lived in the valley, we had an orange tree in the backyard of the parsonage. And it had been killed by a frost or a freeze. And it died back to the ground. Well, the unfortunate thing about that was, it was a wild orange tree. And it froze back before the graft. So that the graft died. And the tree came back from the original root. So it grew. I mean, this thing was 14 feet tall by the time we lived there. But the oranges on it were inedible. Ah! They were so sour, they were worse than lemons. And they didn't even make good lemon juice. In the citrus of the valley, they almost always use the wild orange root because it's impervious to disease. It's berry hardy. But the fruit's lousy. So what they do is, they take that root and they graft in whatever kind of orange they want. Valencias or navels or whatever. Now, when you graft the branch in, it does not become what the tree was. it starts producing its own kind of fruit. But it does it by drawing from the root.
When Israel, as the normal natural branches, when they were growing out of the root that Abraham was, they were growing out as the nation that God had promised Abraham. But when God grafted these wild olives into the thing, that was the Gentiles. And what did they start to produce in terms of fruit? Did he give them a land? No. Did he make of them a great nation? No. Did he give them a great name? No. They started producing a totally different kind of fruit. We know it as the church. It's an international body, has no land, and the name that it's associated with is not its name, but Jesus' name. So, when Paul talks about the grafting, he's talking about God starting a new part of his project, producing a different kind of fruit down the road. So, for Abraham, he got a land to supply his needs, he got a nation to supply his association and security issues, and he got a great name to give him high significance and real status in the eyes of at least God, if not men. With the church, we have no land. We don't get to be a part of a great nation, in spite of what everybody tells you about America. And we don't have a good name. We're blasphemed or maligned. They say evil things about us. What do we get out of this? What is the fatness for us, since we don't have a land or a nation or a great name? The fatness is our relationship with Jesus. Because even though we don't have a land, he said, if you pursue my kingdom and my righteousness, I'll make sure you have stuff to eat and clothes to wear. So you don't have to worry about that. With the land, you're not going to get from the land, you're going to get from me. So what he wanted his disciples to learn when he sent them out and said, don't take your credit cards with you. Secondly, and that's an American, you all know that. Secondly, you don't get to be a part of a great nation. The big visible parts of Christendom are almost all apostate. You don't want to be a part of that. So your sense of security doesn't come from being whatever denominational background you come from. It comes from being with Jesus. I will never leave you or forsake you, he said. So you can't get any more secure than that. And then in terms of the name issue, you don't get a great name. You get to be blasphemed and persecuted and accused of doing evil and all that kind of stuff. So where do you get your sense of significance? From the fact that Jesus died for you. So even though the details changed because the branches changed, the branches indicated a new part of the plan. The old branches had an older part of the plan, but the new branches had a new fruit. There are differences, but the roots are the same, because the real root is you're a tripartite person with three basic need areas and a propensity or a weakness toward deception, and there are basically three promises in the gospel from Jesus. I'll supply your physical needs as you focus on the things that are important. I will never leave you nor forsake you, and I loved you enough to die for you. That gives you what you need. So even though the particulars are different, the basic root is the same, and he calls the outcome fatness. So we participate in a phenomenal life when we walk by faith. But remember, the faith you exercised yesterday won't carry you today. Faith is a continuum, and that means you have to be on your toes. You have a propensity to be deceived into activities that will destroy you. And many times they don't look harmful at all, but they are. So you have to keep on your toes, because this is what faith's all about. It's walking in the light of the words that he gives us and being sensitive to his Spirit's application of them until that particular concept solidifies. And then you start on a new grand adventure. So this evening the focus is on Paul's declaration that because you were grafted into the root that produces this fatness, you have become a partaker of phenomenal privilege, all rooted in the person of Jesus. Okay, are there any questions or comments? Okay, well then let's have a word of prayer together and we can visit for a while. Father, we're grateful to you that you have planned for us a qualitatively superior life. A life by your Spirit, through illumination by your Word, pointing us to Jesus who loved us enough to die for us. And we pray that you would enable us on a daily basis to walk with you in the light. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.